Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Before I start anything else, I wish to dedicate today's program to Bridget Snow, whose 119th birthday was yesterday, November 1st, the day of saintly spirits. She died at age 96 in 1995. And to Elizabeth Baldwin, People's Attorney Extraordinaire, who died on Armistice Day, 2002. To Joanne Rideout, who has retired as KMUN station manager, but she is not quitting the station. She engineers this program, for one thing. And to Carolyn Butler, who started a children's daycare center in Cannon Beach and died of cancer so long ago that perhaps no one remembers her, but I certainly wish to. Today's program is a sort of potpourri, which grew from a tandem succession of Monday's beginning of the Trump trials, Halloween, when children all over the USA marched for candy, yesterday's anniversary of the first detonation of a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb by the United States in 1952, and today's anniversary of the disbanding of the American Revolutionary Army by Congress in 1783. As the famous train and bank robber Cole Younger was fond of saying about almost anything, it's a wonderment. So, because of the delicate nature of today's subjects, I give a disclaimer that it might be my opinion only in our little solar corner of the Milky Way, of which the Vatican acknowledged on Halloween Day, 1992, that Galileo was right. The Earth does circle the sun. The first two are old stories made incredibly relevant by the subject of the final diatribe, and I have more or less updated the old stories in a sense. The first is Children Want Peace. And I wrote this in its original version for the North Long Beach Herald American in 1969. The word peace apparently frightens the most eminent of men, though not so much the women. It would seem as if it were in the domain of peaceniks, an attitude of political style religiously avoided by so many who wish to impress a highness of purpose, particularly in partisan political life, which is in fact at least as bloodthirsty and more viciously sinister than war. This assumption can be partially gleaned through such past examples as the hot potato treatment given by the Long Beach, California City Council during the height of the Vietnam War. The 9 elected city officials, all men, and all who had consistently gone on record supporting nearly every proposal and movement of any war-besotted veterans group, going even so far as to add personal platitudes whether or not they knew what they were talking about, were faced with a 10-page concept towards peace in the spring of 1969, and it utilized the innocence and joy of children. And the city councilman, like Pilate, or perhaps more like the frantic white rabbit who was in a hurry to obey his queen rather than to help Alice, washed their hands of it. I have received a communication concerning a matter that if you were to be concerned at all, and I don't know that you would, the city mayor said to the council, would involve a lot of money and a good deal of activity. This is something concerning Children Want Peace, and I don't know what we're going to do with it. A man had envisioned a children's crusade, not the children's crusade of the Dark Ages when almost all the tiny crusaders were sold into slavery by other good Christians and friars long before they reached the Holy Land. Nor was it to be something in the nature of the Pied Piper who led away the innocents from their corrupted and selfish parents, never to be seen again. The only resemblance to the latter was music, and it was to be created by children, still experiencing a stage of life and purity of intent sorely missed by all who grow older. The guru was hardly the image of other prophets. He was Stanley Slotkin, founder of Abbey Rents. Anything you can imagine, from wheelchairs to wedding caterers, could be rented from Abbey Rents. Yet this man conceived of a concept that could not be appreciated enough with words. He would have children from all over the world gather annually in a single spot and sing songs of peace they have written. Slotkin's idea was to sponsor competitions, song festivals, in every country. Children would write peace songs, and each country would have a well-publicized contest. The child who wrote the best music would share top honors with the child who wrote the best lyrics. Then, for the first International Peace Song Festival, that's what it was to be called, the two winning kids from each country would come to the United States, perhaps in the summer, and perform their compositions to audiences grossing perhaps 15,000 in the flesh, and who knows how many multi-billions on worldwide satellite radio and television hookups. Slotkin was a born promoter. He was indirectly responsible for promoting a hit song that was a song of peace. He wanted to see if people would sing such a song. Searching in 1956, he found one titled, "Let There Be Peace on Earth and Let It Begin With Me." It had only been sung twice, apparently. Slotkin printed copies to send to every church, club, and civic organization in Los Angeles County. Soon he was printing them by the thousands and believed the song would be sung by millions all over the world. Even the Miss Universe contest used it for an opener before Trump. What was important, Slotkin realized, people will sing a song of peace. It was in that year, 1956, that he first conceived of the children musical plea. He explained it in a letter he wrote to the Long Beach City Council. In 1956, I was in a small Asian country at the time England, France, and Israel attacked the Suez Canal. This Asian country had just won its independence, and their foreign department mistook this incident to be the beginning of a Third World War. Air travel was discontinued, and foreigners were given bulletins for 5 days about the events of World War III. Mention was made that Russia was mobilizing, that China was marching, and I lived the first 5 days of the next World War. Finally, flights were resumed, and when I arrived in Manila, I learned the Third World War only lasted 2 days. I had been frightened, and I asked myself, why can't we have peace in this world? If we are hungry, we eat. If we are thirsty, we drink. But humanity has wanted peace since the beginning of time, yet had never had peace. I concentrated on the meaning of the word, peace. My conclusion was that an adult, first, does not understand the meaning of the word peace, and secondly, really does not want peace. Slotkin reached those conclusions because he asked questions. Ask any adult in any country his or her definition of the word peace, Slotkin wrote, explaining he had asked that question of Europeans and Orientals, adults and children. At the end of each answer to you, the word peace becomes an economic explanation of a person's position in the community and involves the size of a man's home and number of bathrooms and the fact he needs another car because his children are growing up and the taxes are too high. When he asked children, what is the meaning of peace? The immediate answer was, it means no war. And because of that answer, so simple and pure, Slotkin bet all his chips on them. He thought children, before they have economic burdens and interests of their elders, could be taught the meaning of peace and the value of peace and the central fact that peace is indeed no war. His reasoning was that within 10 or 15 years, when the children grew up in their respective countries, some of them would conceivably be in a position of deciding whether to conduct peace or war in this tired, frightened, old world. Hitler did such a great job with the children of Germany that they even informed on their own families who paid the penalty of death in the gas chamber sent there by their own children, Slotkin said. If Hitler can do that, then we can teach the children of the world the meaning of the word peace, the desire to have peace, and we will create an influence that in 10 or 20 years from now will bear results. To soothe and entice the financial beast, Slotkin threw out some promotional bait, listing profits of such a spectacle on the scale of the International Peace Song Festival, from ticketed seats, exclusive television rights, album and sheet music sales, even shirts and toys. For the second year, the International Festival would be held in some European capital, such as Rome or London, which Slotkin projected would be a 25% increase in income. For the third year, in the Orient this time, perhaps Hong Kong or Tokyo, Saigon was at war, and apparently no communist nations were to be involved, initially at least, Slotkin added a 25% ticket increase because of what he figured would be rising public interest. Should all the countries in the world eventually enter and wish to send their children to participate, it may be necessary to have a fourth festival somewhere in the world, said the crafty peace entrepreneur. Perhaps in countries on the other side of the Iron Curtain? He never said, but the hint was there. And he never explained why he chose Long Beach to be notified, except that he had hoped to stage the first festival somewhere in Los Angeles County. Long Beach was also a major naval port for the Vietnam War. That same year, the Long Beach City Council was petitioned to withdraw from the war, as had attempted a small Ohio town, Beelsville, which had lost 7 young men to the war, apparently most of the town's latest generation of males. President Richard Nixon had refused the request. The Long Beach City Council refused to hear it, Slotkin's request, ruling that the war was not city business, which was the fate of his idea. Slotkin called his musical crusade, Children Want Peace. Since all children like music and all children seem to be creating enough attention in this world today, Slotkin wrote to the disapproving Long Beach City Council, my plan is to give each child in the world a chance to enter the International Peace Song Festival. Let's get to these young people who are interested in music and who can communicate with music to study the meaning of the word peace. It takes study to write a song of peace. Let's hope that if and when they are in position to make decisions, they will remember their studies and bring peace to this world eventually. None of it ever seemed to have happened. So therefore, and although children do not count in the affairs of their elders, a decade later, children all over the world were still wishing to be heard about nuclear devastation. And so these that follow are by the fourth grade students, or some fourth grade students, at the Bush School in Seattle, Washington, actually two of them, 35 years ago. Their teacher, Joan Marsh, asked for their impressions of nuclear warfare during Nuclear Awareness Week in October 1982. And by Christy Robinson, peace. Wouldn't it be much better if we had more? I think it would be very nice because there wouldn't be any more wars, no more people disliking each other. It would be like an out-of-tune piano if there wasn't peace, but with peace it's like a pattern of harmony and love for each other. If there was peace, it would be like a big flower garden blooming in peace and love. Peace means sharing our food and drink with the people who need it to stay alive, to love everyone good or bad, rich or poor, black or white. Peace is something you can't say with words. It's like feeling deep inside that you can't describe because peace is a type of love, either because it won't really come out of your heart or because it is only your secret and your feelings that will really know what peace is. And peace is beautiful, and that is what it should be to everyone. And by Jenny Westberg. I think if we are mad at someone, we should talk to him or her about it, or someone else who has nothing to do with the fight, or whatever made you mad might get hurt. Conflict between any number of people or countries can cause fights or wars. If it is a fight, people might lose friends and get hurt. Small fights are not serious because usually it is between family members or friends, so they are easily forgotten. If it is a war, billions of people will get killed unless we can stop nuclear bombs and wars and make peace. And those were two nine-year-old fourth graders from the Bush School in Washington. And that story I earlier read about the Children's Crusade, my editor at the North American Herald American yelled at me that I don't want any more of your peace crap. This is a respectable newspaper. Pardon me. The next story that I'm going to read is from my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, which I am afraid was not a respectable newspaper. The People's Bond. And I wrote it. The disclaimer holds. And this course been rewritten, a skosh to update it. Back in the last millennium, at the height of the Vietnam War, as well as the Cold War, a very unwarlike question became popular among the troubled who worried about war. Suppose they gave a war and nobody came. A fascinating thought, except there was always another side almost palpable about the question, more appealing to the darker ancestral, reptile part of ourselves. Suppose there was a war and everybody came. Now, with Donald Trump as America's Wolverine president, this other side of the question must be considered, and its possibilities are infinitely more fascinating. Because, theoretically, and according to the United States Justice Department, which 38 years ago, in October 1979, attempted to squelch an article by Progressive magazine about nuclear physics and how to build an H-bomb, citing it as a threat to national security. Every man, woman, and child in the USA could become a nuclear power as a result of the Progressive publishing the article. The flap began earlier that year when a freelance writer named Hal Moreland toured the nuclear establishment and wrote what he learned for the Progressive. A journalistic leak that got as much attention as Three Mile Island sent the Justice Department scurrying to court with an order to suppress the article. The Progressive refused, quickly wrapping itself in the First Amendment. Lines were swiftly drawn across the country. The Justice Department's argument, representing the U.S. government, was that the national security, a religion you understand, was threatened if the article was published. The Progressive counter-argued that the national security demanded the article be published immediately. The trick was defining national security. One side's view was that national security meant protecting the country from the communists and the crazies who would start building H-bombs in their basements the minute the Progressive article was printed. The other side defined the national security as the Bill of Rights, and in particular the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech and of the press, and their less noisy corollary, the right to know. One citizen took the debate further. He wrote a letter to a few newspapers providing the same information contained in Moreland's article, supporting Moreland's argument that everything in his story was public record and all he did was fit the pieces together. Computer programmer Charles Hansen, who wrote the multi-published letter, was angry that the government had dragged Progressive and Moreland into court when it had never prosecuted the scientists responsible for declassifying the documents Moreland researched. Immediately, the Justice Department sought to quash the letter, but a newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, where the Progressive is published, printed the letter quicker. The Justice Department dropped its case. The government lawyers said it no longer made sense continuing the case when everybody in the country had access to the information. But the possibility of criminal action was threatened. An act of incredible folly was a summation of a Progressive editor. He said, the issues of nuclear weaponry should be open to the public instead of only a self-appointed elite. Everyone must believe in nuclear weapons, he said. They will not disappear simply because we wish them to. We must all understand how these weapons work, and we must be aware of the devastation they can cause. His words were like a fist hitting an open palm. We've got to destroy them before they destroy us. The only chance we've got is nuclear disarmament. Quote, unquote. The Progressive chose its risk carefully. Its decision to commission the article was based on one of the first principles of an open and democratic government. An informed citizenry makes reasonable decisions. The government violated that tenet. It had cloaked almost all information pertaining to nuclear physics in secrecy. And though so much got out, which proves the government is inept as it is shady, it attempted to keep the populace in ignorance and fear, an old trick of despots and despotism. Critics complained the article unnecessarily made the world a more dangerous place to live. The argument seemed based on the premise that the fewer who know or have control over such secrets, the safer the world is for the rest of us. The not-so-distant history of the Third Reich might be enough to reconsider the idea. One man, Adolf Hitler, was largely responsible for the nearly 60 million deaths of World War II. America's own secret wars in Laos and Cambodia, and the recent public revelation that American Special Forces troops and multi-million-dollar drone bases are scattered all over Africa, revealed only because four of them were ambushed and killed in a Vietnam-style ambush just a couple of weeks ago, are not quite the democratic actions our spouted ideals require. Innocent human beings have been destroyed in the name of America in these secret wars, ordered by the same officials who control the secrets of America's nuclear establishment. But the consent of the people was neither sought nor given. If there is any validity to the fear that an enemy could use the disclosed information against us, the nuclear power industry would be the most likely source. The industry exports its technology and material to whoever has the money. The danger is in the secrecy. Power and tyranny grow out of secrecy. Tyranny exists when a government makes its people afraid to know certain things. Time and again since Hiroshima, the world has been at the brink of nuclear suicide. Each time, the rest of us wait in fear while a very few men, and fewer, if any, women, decide if they should destroy civilization, perhaps the entire species of Homo sapiens, which roughly translates humanity the wise. Possessing the secrets of the bomb gives power back to the people. So armed, a sovereign citizenry must be reckoned with. If we must all die in a nuclear holocaust, we should all damned well have something to say about it. And that was, again, something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. And now, a more recent one. Matter of fact, the ink is still not dry on the paper. And again, something I wrote. The bully meets the hammer. As a result of Donald Trump, it is being said among critics, pundits, and comics that the USA has regurgitated as a democracy. Trump has turned out to be, just as predicted and spectacularly quickly, the worst president in American history, which must be a relief to G.W. Bush. He also seems to be the most despicable. He is the dark, angst negative of everything this flawed and fragile constitutional republic attempts to stand and live for. He is the avatar of violence and hatred, yet personally, underneath a fat layer of protective, angry bluster, he is the quintessential coward, confusing narcissistic pomposity for godly pretext. A woman in Atlantic City who refused to sell her property to him called Trump a maggot, a cockroach, and a crumb. Trump's natural instincts are belligerence and to hurt people, personally and en masse, certainly through his Gestapo-like roundups and imprisonment of Hispanic and Muslim immigrants and refugees, not white Europeans, and perhaps imminently through warfare. Our People's Republic is under assault by the highest elected official in the nation, who is suspected of treachery to attain the presidency, who fiercely insists that an autocratic fascist tyranny must replace what he intimates is an antiquated failure of a democracy. He and his White House are engaged in an Orwellian deconstruction of democratic governance. The nation is, as a result, engaged in a third civil war. The first was to separate from mother country England and establish democracy. The second was to bloodily define it by resisting secession and abolishing slavery. And the third is to preserve it from the nihilistic misanthropy that has descended upon it. We are learning to combat and defy an unsuitable president who considers himself an elected despot, despises the First Amendment to the Constitution as fake, but the Second Amendment, the law of the land. Trump and the so-called alt-right he re-inspired to reinvent the early Nazi Party in its destruction of the Weimar Republic in post-World War Germany are essentially traitors to democracy and America in that order. America is, after all, only part of a worldwide historic struggle for liberty, justice, and equality for all. real populism is what Abraham Lincoln said it was: of the people, for the people, and by the people. Populism inspired the Declaration of Independence, but left out women, blacks, and Native Americans. The Revolution was fought for populism by volunteer soldiers, whose successors, later in the French Revolution, were called the People's Armies. It seems quite probable that Trump is willing to take the U.S. and the world to the brink of nuclear holocaust to obliterate every trace of Barack Obama's presidency. He was, after all, the father of the birther conspiracy and has more than once during his campaign and presidency condemned the right of anyone of color to be president of the USA. He also reflects his disdain for a woman as president with an unconstitutional call for the imprisonment of his political rival, Hillary Clinton, especially goaded by her nearly 3 million vote popular victory in the 2016 election. This past Monday was the beginning of what will most likely be a long, thorough trial into Trump's egomaniacal malfeasance and perhaps treachery. If indeed he is eventually found guilty of treason, would it be likely that Trump be the first American president to be executed, quote, for high crimes and misdemeanors, unquote? And to finish, Anita Sue Andrews of Walport, Oregon, asked a pertinent question in a recent letter to the Newport News Times. At what point does the treatment of the American citizens living in Puerto Rico go from gross incompetence to planned genocide with criminal consequences? Quite a question. This is Michael McCusker. Kel Arsland, a former Columbia River bar pilot, has died in his native Norway, where he had lived for several years following his retirement. He was a friend who loved to cook and to argue.